So, yeah. I got here last Tuesday, and then around Thursday, Doug came around and said, you're going to give a talk on Tuesday, and I'll supply you with the title. So on Friday, I was given my title, and I decided to give it a subtitle. And
they
are
not responsible.
Yeah. And so since this is something that I'm sure there's other people in the room who know at least as much about these subjects as I do, we can hopefully launch into some debates and discussions. And so if I had only one slide to give, maybe this would be the one. And you know, I would say, so on grain growth, first of all, we know that ISM grains do grow in high density environments. This happens in dense regions of molecular clouds, and it also happens in protostellar disks. I won't review all that observational evidence, but I will just say that, you know, one of my main points that I'll try and bring home is that this process of grain growth just cannot be blindly extrapolated up to kilometer sizes, and unfortunately, there are still quite a few people who try to do this. And so this sort of oversimplification, it's not only wrong, but it's or probably wrong, but it kind of misses the point. It's because you know, if you look at sort of primitive meteorites, you don't just have a bunch of grains that grew together. You actually have you know, a great abundance, in some cases up to 80%, the most primitive meteorites, of these things called chondrules that are these little melted quasi-spherical things that are about a millimeter in size, right? So this is obviously not the direct consequence of grain growth. So I would view planetesimal formation not as the process of grain growth, but as the process of getting all these chondrules together. And so your initial conditions are that you have a bunch of these millimeter-sized spheres. When you look at the isotopic abundances, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later, we have time, you sort of find that there's sort of a span in ages of these things of about 2 million years. And in particular, the chondrules, there's some evidence that they appear to be 2 million years older than another type of meteoritic inclusion, the CAIs, which are the oldest and sort of most refractory inclusions. And so what this kind of suggests to me is that, you know, it's 2 million years, that's a significant amount of time, right? The lifetimes of these disks are of order a few million years, right? So that's kind of suggests you had this sort of, you know, slight delay in assembling these things into planetesimals because you had all these things that are sort of floating around, and then you eventually get things put together and you have, you know, things in the same solid that are differing in age,
can
apparently.
Can you tell me a little bit more about how you age them? Sorry,
Yeah, so basically it's, I mean, I was going to get into this more later. The, I mean, it's basically from radioactive isotopes, right? I think the absolute ages are done with sort of with lead dating. I think that's the best. And I actually don't know the details of the systematics of that. The relative ages you can get from short-lived radioactive isotopes, short-lived radionuclides. So these are elements that have half-lives that are comparable to a million years.
Yeah.
And so then you find these. So we'll get, yeah.
Yeah.
There, we have a slide.
Can I also ask one more question?
Yeah.
Even if you don't go into the details on looking at the grain, the actual spread of grain ages, let me ask, when you say there's a span of 2 million years, you're talking from rock to rock, but not within the same rock. Is that correct?
Well, so yeah, so this is still somewhat controversial. So the claim is that chondrules are 2 million years younger than CAIs, and chondrules and CAIs are in the same rock.
So in the same rock, maybe I should get Stan's attention on this as well.
Yeah.
In the same rock, do you see ages that are spread in the same rock that has a spread of age of 2 million years, or is it rock to rock that is 2 million years? In other words, we see, I mean, it's often said that they have an age spread of several million years. But I wanted to know is whether it comes from within the same rock that you see this, or do you see from rock to rock? How homogeneous is one given rock?
I knew the answer to that at one time, but I don't.
I think it's like Andrew said.
If you believe the age difference, yeah.
More refractive things are older. But what about the spread of chondrules themselves? How big is that?
So again, I think that's also of order, but I'm not sure the answer to that question if that's in the
fractionation within one rock. When you look at individual chondrules, is there evidence that the fractionation, the composition of chondrules from one chondrule to another chondrule is very different? In other words, could you see chondrules which is primarily made of iron and next to a chondrule which is made of, let's say, some more volatile material?
I think they're pretty consistent within a particular meteorite.
It's very homogeneous within it. That was my impression.
And there's also some differentiation. There's elements missing in the chondrules that then appear in the matrix, which implies local formation.
But my impression, correct me if this is wrong, is that within one rock, the age and the composition of the chondrules are very homogeneous. But from rock to rock, they're very different.
I think that's true.
But I think that's different from what Pavel and Andrew is saying.
But
I don't know whether this is, it's something we need to clarify at some point. But
yeah. Well, so again, I think the strongest point, again, we're saying is that, if you believe that the CAIs are older than the chondrules, and there's many people who say
that, agree with
that, and it's sort of indisputable that chondrules and CAIs exist in the same meteorites, right? I mean, you just have, I've seen them at the Museum of Natural History. If anyone's in New York City, they have the Ross Hall of Meteorites.
Yeah, I have a piece.
And I'm sure you have nice samples as well. And so we'll get back to chondrules, but let me just talk about the sort of sticking issue, since that's also an interesting problem. And this sort of is how I like to think about it conceptually. So you have, two objects that are going to collide, and you want to figure out if they can stick. And so these objects, they start out at a large distance from each other with some relative kinetic energy. And then as they approach each other, that kinetic energy is going to increase if you have some binding energy. And so I've drawn it here as if it's a smooth potential, like gravity, that it's falling into. But of course, it could also be a contact force, which would be sort of spikier. And then you have impact, right? And sort of during that impact, messy things happen. And you're going to lose some fraction of your total kinetic energy. And so to get things to stick, you actually don't have to lose all your kinetic energy, because you still have to climb out of that potential well. So right, if you just lose enough kinetic energy to get sort of within the binding energy of zero, then you'll wind up with a bound object and you'll get coagulation. So I've sort of written this that, you can imagine that the amount of energy you lose is sort of some fraction of this total energy you have at impact, and you can imagine it's kind of hard to get F, exactly equal to 1. But the problem is if your binding energy is negligible compared to your kinetic energy, I'm going to argue that that's the case with most macroscopic solids, then you are forced into a situation where you have to lose sort of all your kinetic energy in this impact, and that's something that's, that there's really no good ideas on how to do.
What about rotation? Could it go to rotate spin energy? Two balls, they stick when they rotate.
Sure. I don't know how you'd, yeah, I mean, this is obviously a simple toy model.
Another point is you can collide many times. And that's how, the first time you collide, you may not, you can bounce again.
Yeah.
Right? The first time you may not dissipate all that energy, and they will bounce again.
Yeah, sure. But in addition to energy being dissipated, there's presumably some. So let's talk about what generates the velocities first, right? Okay. And so the sort of most the most general source of velocities among solids is just the aerodynamic drag that they experience with the gas. And sort of the scale of these velocities is set to it's the Keplerian velocity reduced by this parameter eta, which is a ratio of thermal energy to orbital kinetic energy. And so that's around 50 meters per second, relatively independent of where you are in the disk. And so that velocity difference, that's going to be the velocity difference between some big boulder that has a very long stopping time. This axes here are sort of a non-dimensionalized stopping time. The two axes are the same, so you don't have to worry about reading that. So the larger particles will have a large stopping time, and they'll basically be going on Keplerian orbits, whereas small particles will be sort of caught up in the gas. They'll be rotating slower by this 50 meters per second. And so that's the sort of relative velocities you see in these regions. It turns out that 50 meters per second is also the speed of the radial drift of particles that have a stopping time that's comparable to the dynamical time. So most of you probably know this. And so this is the sort of famous problem of the meter-sized solids having an in-spiral velocity of 50 meters per second. So you have to worry if you pass through the meter size range that you're going to lose these boulders into the sun in timescales of 100 years. What isn't quite as well appreciated is that actually if you go out further in the disk, it turns out that these marginally coupled particles it's a smaller size scale, so it's actually the centimeter size particles that are doing this fastest radial drifting out at the distance of the Kuiper belt. So you see these sort of fingers here of the highest velocity impacts are again due to the fast radial drift of these marginally coupled particles. And the sort of one feature you notice here is that there's this sort of valley of low velocity impacts. So you might say, oh, maybe you can just sort of manage to nudge things through this valley. There's two problems. One is that the process of growing things collisionally necessarily generates a dispersion in sizes, which will generate a velocity dispersion. And sort of another fact is that if you include turbulence, then that will sort of generate velocity dispersions between particles of similar sizes. So the reason in here you have no relative velocity between particles of the same size, because they're experiencing the same drag force, of course. I think this is probably fairly old hat to most people.
Low speed is a problem for you, or high speed is a problem for you?
So at
both are a problem. Either you don't accumulate or you shatter everything. So neither one is.
Yeah. So high speed is a problem because it's hard to stick.
Shattering. Yeah.
And or bounce or yeah.
Bounce is a narrow range of energy.
Yeah.
Above that, you just go back to small sizes.
Yeah. And you're worried about low velocities because you just don't get significant collision rates. Yeah. So I think the more serious problem is the high velocities. But because in our disk, you're going to get at least a collision per orbital period, no matter what you do.
Yeah. These things probably have very castle structures, so they're very dissipating in collisions. So you dissipate a lot of energy in the process of collision.
That's
probably a very rare thing.
Yeah, because these extended structures are. There's lots of issues with these sort of tenuous fractal structures that people talk about. They tend to also be very fragile, like you say. Um, So okay, so let's if you're talking about, you know, chemical sticking, then that basically means sort of van der Waals interactions. And sort of the issue here is that this is basically a surface energy, right? And sort of the fundamental problem with the surface force is that it will decrease as the particle grows larger, as the surface area to volume ratio, right?
That's assuming that the surface is a crystal and without fractal structures on the surface, right?
Yeah, so you can get a little higher dimensionality. But again, this idea of fractal structures, I mean, I can see it applying on, you know, when you have, sort of individual grains. But at some point, as you get sort of past millimeter and centimeter sizes, you're going to get something that's...
They're very porous. I mean, many of these asteroids are very, very porous. They're like loose gravels.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the fact that they break, comets break up, in the tidal field, right? They may be very loose. I know about this concept that, you know, you're probably referring to. This. It's more like a solid structure, right?
So let's just go the simple case where we think of things as a solid first. Just to sort of set the energy scales for these binding energies. And so as you see, for ice, which is a pretty sticky thing, the energies are maybe what you expect, sort of an EV per nanometer squared. And sort of the most naive and I think generous thing you can do is say that the surface area that goes into contact is the entire surface area of some object of size R. You can just compare that to its kinetic energy, some object with internal density rho. And then you see that for millimeter-sized solids, you get this again, very, very simplistic argument. You can see this upper limit of speeds that are under a meter per second. And you know, I think this is fairly generous. Sort of a more detailed analysis was done by Choksi and collaborators, sort of taking into account the Young's modulus of solids and thinking of what's the actual sort of contact area that gets generated in a collision. And sort of when they do this estimate, they get that actually millimeter size solids, the sort of dividing line between sticking and bouncing is only a centimeter per second for millimeter size solids. But perhaps, and so this is perhaps too pessimistic because again, it's assuming sort of only elastic deformation of the solids. But sort of the main point is that whatever this dividing line is, it's going to be something that as the particles get larger and larger, that critical velocity is going to continue to plummet. So this is a problem that only gets worse, you know, until you get all the way to kilometer sizes, at which point you have a surface gravity that becomes significant. You have an escape speed of order a meter per second once you're a kilometer. But before that, of course, the surface gravity is negligible, as are sort of electrostatic energies and anything you can think of. So this is sort of the base problem. The binding energies, are not really going to do it for you. So you have to sort of account for then, say, oh, is there something that can just incredibly efficiently get rid of all this kinetic energy, essentially with 100% efficiency? The first thing you might think of is to consider plastic deformation in addition to elastic. That's really not applicable to rocks. There's also a somewhat narrow range of impact stresses at which plastic deformation is sort of confined to the body. The best idea is sort of what Doug was talking about and what a lot of people talk about is that while these things are not intact solids, but they're sort of it's basically an aggregate, and that these aggregates can basically shift around. And justification for this is where if you look at the moon, it's sort of covered with this little covered with a regolith. It's not just a hard rock on the surface. And perhaps the best analogy is that if you just think of sort of bean bags, and they were to collide into each other, all the beans sort of interpenetrate and move around, But the problem is that you're talking about bean bags that do not have a confining surface to them, right? So when these things collide, there's going to be a lot of, you know, energy put into these motions, and you know, what is there to sort of keep, you know, sort of keep the beans attached to each other? And so the more formal way to express that concern is you'd have sort of mass loss during these collisions from cratering. And sort of the models of Stu Weidenschilling sort of claim to take this into account, and he has sort of a critical velocity at which point cratering gives you more mass loss than your impactor. The problem is that though that number is based on experiments done by Hartmann, which are done in the Earth's gravitational field. And of course, the gravitational field on, say, a meter-sized solid is some million times weaker than the Earth's gravitational field, so you might expect much more mass to be lost. So I don't think this effect has been treated consistently.
The new results in cratering into rubble pile type objects showing essentially that there's very little projectile.
In zero gravity, or?
In centrifuge.
Okay. Okay, I'd be interested in looking at that. So
the other aspect is you really need to take into account that you're not in isolation. Okay. In a sense, when these collisions occur in the solar nebula environment, they're not in isolation. The gravity of the sun does play a role. So these guys at the center mass move together. Okay. They don't, you know, the fact that if you have one AU, no matter what size you are, you're 1% inside your Roche radius. So even if you were to go out, okay, up to 100 times your size, you'll come back together again. Okay, it's not like in free space. This is a misconcept. People think that I take a rock and put it and I smash it. It's either going to go parabolic or it's going to does nothing. But in fact, you can go up to 100 time these size and still come back together in this gravity environment.
Yeah, so that still depends on...
Because it's inside its Roche radius. It's almost independent of mass. This physical size at 1 AU is always 1% the Roche radius. So within the Roche radius, they move around the same speed and they will come back together again. It's just like cometary tails.
Even though
the cometary tails are not gravitationally bound to the head, they move on the same orbit, and they can come back and collide again.
But what if gas strike is important? I mean,
yeah, well, that's a separate issue. Yeah. But it applies to all of it. Yeah. It doesn't give you a dispersive. The gas strike doesn't give you a dispersive motion.
It does for particle sizes.
That needs to be looked at. But I'm saying is it's not just entirely in this regime that you think in terms of isolation.
So, yeah, no, I mean, there certainly are. I mean, yeah, it's something I sort of would have talked about if I was perhaps not given this title, the effects of sort of two fluid, you know, interactions and how, you know, gas drag can do very interesting things. But yeah, and then sort of another argument that you hear quite a bit is that, well, these things are not dry rocks, but they're, you know, maybe sticky organics and, you know, that can give you effects such as you know, viscoelastic deformation, which is sort of a time-dependent relation between stress and strain. And I think the basic problem with this is that even, you know, when you look at the, you know, most carbon-rich carbonaceous chondrites, they still just don't have that much carbon. It's the cosmic abundances are not that high. So I think doing these things as tar balls is not very realistic. And I think even if, and there are experiments done on things that are 100% organics, and it's still not convincing. You know, they can manage to get centimeter-sized things to stick at a meter per second if it's at the right temperature. But you know, that's a long ways to saying you can get to kilometer sizes everywhere at a wide range of temperatures. So this is a picture of a chondrule. It looks sort of better on my computer screen than it does up here, or sort of a meteorite with lots of little chondrules in it. And I actually found this picture on a website that had a web book that was entitled creation science, compelling evidence for creation and the flood. And so they're sort of very very critical of astronomers, as you might imagine, and came up with their own theory for meteorites in the asteroid belt. And this is the hydroplate theory, that sort of the asteroids were generated by sort of fountains of the deep, sort of brings you back to the flood. And sort of mentions that, you know, the hydraulic pressures are not enough to sort of explode the entire Earth, but it's enough to get a fraction that's one part in 1,666 of the Earth off into space. And so these are the fountains of the deep that launched this, rocks and mud from the Earth. And of course, as astronomers, we're Earthbound and we're looking out into the stars, and so we cannot notice what's at our feet. So let's turn to some more heretical thoughts here on chondral formation. And so here are just some of the things you need to think about. The most obvious is, so again, these chondrules were heated and partially melted, and the heating was was fairly brief. If it's time scales of days or something like that. And it's very efficient because, again, there's significant fraction of of the meteorite are these inclusions that have been melted. So it's efficient, but not perfectly efficient, because you also, it wasn't the whole disk that went through this, because you do also find primitive grains that are unprocessed. And there's some evidence that there's even some chondrules that have undergone multiple heatings. You can actually see joint chondrules and sort of to reproduce the surface textures and whatnot. And then there's a lot of interesting evidence on, these so-called extinct short-lived radionuclides. So again, extinct means that you're not actually finding the unstable isotopes. You're, of course, finding the daughter products that have already decayed because they're short-lived. And so basically, what happens is, you look in, you look in a chondrule and you see a bunch of magnesium that sort of correlates with the amount of aluminum. And so then that tells you a bunch of magnesium 26 that correlates with the amount of stable aluminum. And so that tells you, there must have been, a certain amount of unstable aluminum back when this rock first formed, right? And so it really tells you about the time of formation, because this thing, it's not enough that there was, if the rock gets altered, sort of remelted or differentiated or something, then the magnesium is going to go back together and hang out with its magnesium friends and not want to be with all the aluminum that it got trapped with. So that's sort of my simplistic sort of explanation of all this. There's some interesting sort of systematics about all these. The iron 60. So that one's actually not found in CAIs. I think it is found in some chondrules, and it's also found in differentiated meteorites. So this actually, the constraint on this is that it tells you that planetesimals actually formed and differentiated within about 10 million years. And so similarly, this hafnium and tungsten, how does it work again? One of them, so I think hafnium is a lithophile, or is it a siderophile? Which one is it? Yes. Yeah, which one likes the metals? And the, so the hafnium is the lithophile that likes the rocks. And oops. So the hafnium, right? So it likes the rocks. You get a large enough body and it will differentiate. And so all the tungsten, which likes the metals, is going to preferentially go into the core. Okay, but then if subsequently you then have some hafnium that decays, you're going to have this hafnium that's in the this tungsten that's going to be in the hang out with all this rocks where it shouldn't be. And so this gives you interesting time constraints on sort of the differentiation of, bulk of asteroids and planets. I think it tells you that Vesta The claim is that it formed and differentiated within sort of 3 to 5 million years, and then sort of the shortest time constraints on the formation and differentiation of Mars and the Earth also come from this, and the numbers are it's around 10 million years for Mars, which is, you know, astonishingly short, and for Earth it's like 30.
But that's been revised all.
Oh, it's all old.
Yeah.
Down or up?
Down.
Even shorter.
Much faster. I thought there was sort of the incredible amount of controversy on this issue. Is that?
It's been settled that it's shorter.
Yeah. Is it?
Alex, it was something that ETH originally had a longer time. The more recent people have done that, he agrees now that it's shorter for
information. I see. Okay.
So
there's no need for delayed Earth formation. Look at Firebark.
Delay, I wouldn't, yeah. So what does this put Mars's formation at then? In less than 10 million years? Yeah, so yeah. Okay. So now let's get on to these beryllium isotopes, because they're...
Really?
They're pretty interesting. So beryllium-10 has been, you know, discovered and confirmed in CAIs, and this was at first interesting because sort of all these other isotopes, there's sort of a debate going on as to whether, you know, whether they came from a supernova or whether it came from spallation reactions from the protostar itself, right? And so you can make arguments in favor of either case for all these elements. But beryllium, on the other hand, is not generated in beryllium-10 is not generated in nucleosynthesis. It's only generated in spallation reactions, or so it was thought. And so this seemed to be sort of as Frank Shu claimed, a smoking gun in favor of sort of protostellar flares. But then recently, I guess, there are a couple of claims. One is that you can actually make beryllium-10 in the jets of supernova. I guess that's why Al Cameron has claimed that. And then Steve Desch has claimed that actually the galactic cosmic ray flux was higher in the past, and so you actually can get spallation from galactic cosmic rays to give you this beryllium-10. So there's still some debate on that. But then even more recently, there's a claim of the discovery of beryllium-7 in CAIs. And the issue with that is that beryllium-7 has a half-life of only 53 days, right? Just astonishingly short. And so for this element to get, you know, trapped in a rock within, you know, some, you know, time scale of order years, there's obviously no way that something can, you know, travel from an external stellar source and get into the solar system in that time scale. So, you know, if this pans out, then this would, you know, truly be, a smoking gun in favor of spallation within the solar system.
But that's quite controversial, isn't it?
There's one detection, and it's pretty recent. So I don't know if anyone else has any comments on that. But it's not so recent that sort of Frank and colleagues have already had time to put it into their models and say they can reproduce it.
About 7 days.
Yeah. Not quite that fast, but yeah. Yeah, this is just a mean life. There's some of them that decay in 7 days. So getting back to these different theories, I guess so. This heating, again, there's two ideas for where, well, several ideas for where the heating can come from. If you're Frank, you think the heating comes, again, you're for the same reason that you're near the star to catch all these flares, and you're also hot because you're near the star, and as you get sort of lifted out of the disk, you get this, you know, intense exposure to the sun's radiation, and that's enough to give you this partial melting as you then get thrown out to AU distances. And then the other ideas that tend to go along with people who favor these elements coming from a supernova are that it's either shocks within the disk. It's sort of been shown that you can reproduce a lot of chondral properties by sort of Mach 5 shocks, 5 to 10 shocks, The problem, of course, is how do you generate a Mach 5 to 10 shock in a low-mass protostellar disk? And that has not been really answered well. And then another idea of lightning, and I don't know how well people understand lightning on Earth, let alone in protostellar disks. Then sort of other constraints are that there's obviously some efficient size sorting. The size dispersion of these chondrules is fairly narrowly peaked around a millimeter. And there are some, you know, evidences, you know, I don't want to be too loyal to my advisor, that that might sort of point away from the X-WIN model. There's sort of a claim that I think, like Stan was mentioning, if you sort of look at any meteorite, there's sort of a claim that there's some complementarity, that sort of whatever is missing from the chondrules is in the matrix. And so that suggests that this is something that happened locally, not being delivered. But again, you're talking about, you know, of course the chondrules are going to be sort of depleted in volatile elements, so you'd expect a certain amount of complementarity. Just
in cosmic chemists, they'll all say the same thing. Like if you look at chondrules in different meteorites are different, but they're always similar to it. They have relationships to the matrix they're in.
Yeah.
And they all say that uniform.
Yeah.
It's pretty hard to get around.
Yeah.
So that's the matrix we love it.
Yeah. But I'm fine.
I don't know why Frank's model persists. Why is it persistent? There's all these contradictory points.
You got a strong-willed guy saying this is the way it is.
Yeah.
A good example in our own country here.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with the Kurt Liefman?
I'm afraid not. Yeah. So why should I be? Yeah.
Because he would claim to have had this theory before your advisor. So
wow.
A little book.
There he is.
I'll write his name down for you.
Yeah.
Oh, what about the multiply melted chondrules? There's a chance that they have been melted and remelted and so on.
Oh,
some of them have double rings.
Oh, yeah, well,
is that consistent with the X-wind or something?
Yeah, I don't think that's a big problem, because again, things do radially drift back towards the star, and so something that just doesn't get thrown particularly far for whatever reason can find its way, you know, back into the irradiation region. I think there's more serious concerns, I guess, with this these locality constraints. There is something very appealing about the fact that you can do if it's true, that you could do everything within the solar system and not have to, you know, because there's a claim that, you know, with some of these isotopes, I think not the ones I've shown here, but there's some debate of whether you can get it from just a single supernova or whether you need sort of multiple sources near the solar system going off at just the right time.
I think Frank's right in claiming that some of the shortly rated.
Yeah.
No question about that.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean the whole story is exactly as he says.
Yeah.
I had a comment on shocks as the heating mechanism. But of course, the planets, further planets, are great generators of shocks. Big wakes that they have are potentially interesting.
Oh, no,
things
it's
because
a,
they,
okay.
You know, proto-Jupiter generated waves which were strong exactly in the asteroid region. That's where these waves are really big and so on. There are some problems because of the required Mach number.
Yeah, it's quite high, yeah.
7 kilometers a second or something.
Yeah.
And that turns out to be a nasty problem because these waves actually tend to go more propagate more radially as they get away from Jupiter, and if you use dispersion relation, which theorists love to do, then you get 7 kilometers a second, just the required speed. But if you use the hydrodynamical simulations, you look at the shape of the pitch angle, it's different, and it's, then you get only 1 or 2 kilometers per second. So, but otherwise, something like that would be a nice. You would then say that chondrules were formed not at the very beginning, but they were like the last batch of solid build.
That's what.
Yeah, I mean, I don't. Yeah, so I don't know if that's, you know, if that's a problem with for them the CAIs, which of course are thought to be even older, but then you have the problem that you have to sort of form a Jupiter, and then there's already time constraints on making Jupiter, and then if you add the time constraints to Jupiter to then the 2 or 3 million years you need to make all the chondrules and CAIs, then you're talking about sort of a very long time. But maybe the creation scientists like the idea of a wave. That kind of sounds like the flood. So so I guess that's pretty much. I did have a slide on what I actually do, but I can sort of talk about that with people individually. I mean, just sort of very briefly, it's my sort of prejudice was obvious that I don't think sticking is a terribly viable mechanism. And in particular, if you look at a textbook on contact mechanics, coagulation or sticking do not appear in the book. Like, there's this classic text by Johnson. They just don't mention the possibility. I mean, they calculate lots of, what's epsilon? The index of, not the index of refraction, the coefficient of restitution. And, you know, I never seen a coefficient of restitution that goes to zero in any of those plots. So I favor gravitational instability, and there's been a lot of work done by a lot of people here on sort of the implications of, you know, what has to happen in terms of turbulence in the disk in order to get gravitational instability to go, and I'll continue to work on that with people here.
Andrew, is that a real surname?
Oh, no, that's, yeah, abbreviated. I should have put a period, I guess. Why? Why not? Yeah. So.
Okay.
And I have reprints of papers, including one that came out on February 1st with Eugene Chang. So if you want any of those, they're up here. Thanks.
Thank you.